So I'll apologize now if I blast you out of the room. I'm not used to speaking to the microphone. I tend to be a loud person, so hopefully this won't be too painful. Let me just say that when I did this study, I wasn't expecting to do this study. Okay? So I'm not a mechanical engineer, and I'm basically an electrophysiologist who started working with a group of people who wanted to help improve the situation with long-term indwelling electrodes for recording stimuli in the brain. And in so doing this, we discovered that there are all sorts of, just need to get organized here. There are lots of things that we didn't really know about, and we needed to kind of start piecing through this problem. So we're not getting things to work, so we'll just do the old-fashioned way. We really needed to work through and try to figure out how we're going to deal with all the problems you have when inserting something into the brain. And these problems were really very common to not just recording and stimulating electrodes, but anything that you want to do invasively with the brain. They're also common to any sort of brain injury type of incidents. And a lot of the same motivations come into play in these sorts of things. So whenever you have damage, insertion of a foreign object, for example, into the brain, you have all sorts of problems, which we've talked about. You have necrosis, apoptosis that occurs downstream from that. You have inflammatory processes and gliosis, and these things are iterative. So if you start killing cells, you cause inflammation, which then starts initiating more apoptosis, which causes more inflammation, which on and on and on until eventually the system kind of settles down and finds some new static point, and away you go. Our goal was to try to figure out if there were a way we could adjust the properties of the implants or the methodologies involved to implant things into the brain that might help reduce these types of conditions. And just to kind of illustrate the severity of this, I don't know how well you can see this out there, but basically this is staining with GFAP for astrocytes that are activated around where there had been a silicon implant in the olfactory bulb. Okay, now I will say that this was not a silicon electrode array that's tethered to the skull the way they usually are. This is actually a free-floating piece of silicon. Okay, so we've already removed one of the major problems with a stiff, rigid probe going into the brain, which they're usually tethered to the rigid skull. Okay, and you still see, depending on how well you can see this, this bright red, which is these astrocytes, making a very tight seal around the silicon, and then all the radiating processes moving out for over 100 microns in every direction. Okay, so this is something we're really trying to avoid here. So what do we have to think about? There's a lot of literature that talks about things that affect the type of biocompatibility we're really interested in the long term. There's the size of the implant, there's the shape of the implant, there's the material of the implant. Is it biologically, you know, inert, or is it going to be chemically reacting to things? And incidentally, just because it may be a piece of polymer that isn't being degraded or having a breakdown sort of process within the brain, that doesn't mean it's chemically inert, because one of the things that happens is you pass current. We have all this electrolysis that starts occurring, and it's no longer chemically inert. You actually have something that's quite active. So that's a very interesting problem. There is the basic compliance issue that we've been talking about, is the stiffness of the surfaces, the stiffness of the probe in general, and whether or not you're going to set up shears with respect to the tissue, because the implant is actually connected to something rigid outside of it. So the skull being rigid and the brain being a viscoelastic, viscoplastics type of structure, having this rigid object in it is going to act like a constant knife blade stuck inside your brain. So every time you jiggle, you're basically causing a laceration. So this type of thinking is what we're trying to deal with. And lastly, we started looking at something which really hadn't received much more than kind of incidental, kind of, well, if we put things in slowly, maybe things will move out of the way and maybe it's not so bad. And some electrophysiologists insist the only way you can do this is to move your electrode a micron and go have a coffee, move it another micron and, you know, have a cigarette, and basically work through the last couple of hours of their implantation. That's the only way they get good recordings. So we started thinking about this process as cell migration and said, well, hey, cells can travel through the mature brain and they can do this just fine. It doesn't seem to cause a big problem. So we wanted to start thinking about the idea of would rate affect these types of issues. And so we actually decided to go and do the experiment. And what we discovered, which you can't see terribly well, unfortunately, is that if we just put something in rapidly, this is a piece of polymer now, at 1 millimeter per second, we get a fairly decent astrocytic scar around the implant site. And that we could actually measure this quantitatively to see the amount of staining with distance from the probe. And this is just a control area outside of the scar so that we have something to normalize the amount of astrocytosis that should be occurring. Well, not astrocytosis, but the amount of fluorescence you would get from just the astrocytes in a random chunk of tissue of this similar nature. If we put the implant in at 1 millimeter per hour, we had a massive reduction in this astrocytic scar, which you can see here relative to the fast implant. Okay, this is a statistically significant improvement. This is still an order of magnitude faster than what cells actually migrate through the brain. So this led us to conclude that maybe we were onto something with this idea of rate. So this is kind of, you know, saying there are more things to be thinking about than just what the material is. Okay, and we know that people are working very hard with implants to remove some of the tethering forces and softening these tethers so that you don't have such a compliance mismatch in that regard. So people are really thinking through how to re-engineer this. But the next objective that we really had was we wanted to now start working with compliant materials such as polymers as the basis for our implants. Well, if you go to the engineer, the first thing they're going to say, okay, fine, we're polymer engineers. We can make anything you want. So how stiff does it have to be? How much force does this thing have to deal with when you put it in? Okay, so we're working in mouse brain, and guess what? We don't have any information as to what to be expecting in mice. Plus, all the force measurements that had really been made when we started doing this were done with a specific probe, which you can't generalize properties from in order to try to design what you need to actually insert into the brain. Okay, so this is how we came about doing this project, is more of a matter of trying to guide our engineering cohort to figure out how to do this. So what we wanted to do is really look at the forces involved in putting things into the mouse brain. So here is the cerebral cortex of the mouse and the olfactory bulbs of the mice. Now, the olfactory bulb was of particular interest to us because I was working along with a person who actually does a lot of work in the olfactory bulb. So he was highly motivated to get something to stick in the olfactory bulb. This is a couple of millimeters size structure. Okay, it's huge relative to the mouse brain in general, but it's pretty small. So this is a really wonderful place to try to optimize things. But what are the properties of this versus the cerebral cortex, which most people are actually interested in that? Okay, so what we decided to do is try to look at the material properties of the brain as if it were something like a piece of rubber. Okay, so we have these material scientists over here that says, well, let's do indentation tests. So that's what we geared up to do. So basically what we did is we took a little load cell, which is this little device right here. So it's basically a little piezo sensor that's like in all of your analytical balances. We mounted it on a rod, which is attached to a motor-driven micromanipulator, so we can control the rate the micromanipulator moves, so we can actually look at things like the forces, the different insertion rates, and we can control the distance it travels very accurately. This has a 40 nanometer stepper motor in it, so we have pretty good control of what we're doing. It's still big compared to the AFM, but nobody wants us to put a mouse in their AFM. Okay, so this is what we resorted to. And what you see here is we have a stereotactic device so we can hold the mouse, but in this case we're just holding a plastic glove because nobody likes to see pictures of mice. So we also borrowed from this literature of the material scientists and said, okay, we want to generalize this. So we're going to use cylindrical punches. So we use 100 micron diameter or a 200 micron diameter cylindrical punch along with a sharpened 200 micron cylindrical punch. And so these were going to be our devices that we were going to use so we can borrow from the literature of these nice uniform punches and say we've already worked out what we should be expecting if we're going to be putting this against indentation testing on a soft material. And that's kind of where we started. So this is what you get when you put, and I should mention that these little devices are stainless steel, so again, it's fairly rigid, and they're mounted in the end of the measuring the load cell so that they're orthogonally oriented, we can drive that properly. Now, this is what you see if you record the forces as you put it put one of these objects into the brain. So what you see is we've been planning for 1.5 millimeters, and that we are initially looking at about one millimeter per second. It's a little bit slower than that. That's what the manipulator thought it was doing, but it wasn't quite doing at that rate. So this is the force that's generated as you are inserting the electrode, probe into the brain. And at 1.5 millimeters, it stops for 20, 30 milliseconds, and then it reverses direction. So what you see is a gradual building of forces. And then when it stops, you see a drop in force as the tissue relaxes. And then as we start to retract it, you see that there's actually force being pushed back against the probe, which then at this point, we lose that force pushing back at the probe, and now it's a matter of pulling the probe back out of the tissue. So it's a negative force that we're pulling it back out now. So the next step from this is to say, this is a fairly complex shape. How can we extract material properties from this complex shape? This does not look like an ideal viscoelastic type of material. There's something else going on here. But what can we actually learn from this particular material? So the first thing the material scientists want to look at, and we've been talking about over and over again, is modulus. So if we look at the assumptions that this is a linear material, which we know it isn't, but you see there's a region in the initial insertion where basically the tissue is not cutting. It is simply compressing, that it acts fairly linearly. With respect to force, distance and force, a fairly linear relationship. So we're going to concentrate on that area, and from that, we can just basically use the rate of change of force, the diameter of the probe, Young's Poisson's ratio, and we can determine a Young's modulus, quote unquote. Okay, so obviously, there are some assumptions here which you have to take into effect, which is that the brain is a linear, elastic, and incompressible material. It's really not, as we discussed, but since it's acting that way in this region, it's a reasonable assumption to start from that it, at least in this region, it's behaving in that fashion. And of course, it's important that it's actually the slope is actually linear in this area, otherwise this whole argument falls apart. Okay. And what we actually then extract is this is what we find for our Young's modulus. Okay, I should say that the errors on this, the variation animal to animal, is fairly high. Despite the fact that this is a 200 micron diameter punch, okay, which is reasonable size for looking at these sorts of devices, it's still pretty big compared to the cells. Okay, so there's a lot of inhomogeneity that we're kind of pushing underneath all of this, and we're not going to be putting this punch down in exactly the same place. Okay, it's going to be reasonably similar. I try to avoid the superficial large blood vessels, but you can't get it exactly in the right spot to compare perfectly animal to animal. So one thing to remember is there's going to be variability here, and the exact number may not be the most important take-home, but more what changes as we change the parameters and how things move around and understanding what's happening. All right. So then the next thing that we see in these recordings is after this linear area, we then get this drop in the force per distance here. Okay, so the slope is decreasing. What we feel is happening at this point is that the probes are actually penetrating into the brain. Now, according to the soft material type of assumptions, this should be a type 2 ring crack, which means basically if you're punching this cylinder into the tissue, there's going to be a formation of a tear basically right around that. So there's going to be a column of tissue you're compressing, there's going to be a tear around it, and this other material is going to be moving out laterally. So you get a ring crack. It sits around this core that you're compressing. So this is kind of the mechanics, supposedly, of what's happening here. It would be really nice to go back to two-photon microscopy during this and see if this is actually what's happening. But we feel that in this area, that's basically what happened. And we can actually take, and looking at that transition point, this is what we pull out as the penetration force. And you can actually see this. If you do recordings, you can actually see the tissue dimples, and then suddenly you get a relaxation of the surface as it actually penetrates. And not having actually videotaped this while we were doing it, all I can say is it's reasonable that this is the point at which we would actually see the dimple relax and it's penetrating the tissue. But we don't have that in the proper form to make that a really solid conclusion. But we can take this value and we can use that as a measure of how much force it takes to now penetrate the tissue. And we come up with a number. So there we have a number. Very nice. Now I want to point out that in the cortex, we have a third area here where the force goes up again very markedly per unit distance. So we have a third stage. Well, it turns out that if we look at what's going on in a mouse brain at 0.9 millimeters to 1, is you actually see that you're going through the cerebral cortex and you're entering into the corpus callosum. Okay, so this is a dense white matter fiber tract, which I do know is actually pretty stiff. And what you actually do see is that you get an increase in the force. Now, we didn't really quantify this because there's a great deal of variability in this. So we just kind of said, okay, there's an increase in force. It's a tissue in it's not homogeneous in this area. Okay, so that's fine. We know that. We're not really interested in recording from the hippocampus underneath anyway. So we have some measures. We'll move on and keep trying to find useful information. And again, we can extract, we want to start thinking about what else we can find now. So the next thing we want to look at is the frictional forces. So I told you about this transition here just so you're aware of it, but friction is going to play a part in all these forces that we see. What we wanted to see is if we could figure out an area where we can get an idea of what the frictional coefficient might be. And really, what we'd like to see is during this linear area here, this in theory should just be a function of the unloading of the tissue, the modulus of the material pushing back on the probe, the diameter of the probe, and the frictional coefficient. So we should be able to extract the frictional coefficient. The problem gets into the fact that we're seeing a lot of noise in these recordings. Well, let's think about what happens when we put the probes into the brain. You're basically cutting through all sorts of blood vessels, and you're encountering all sorts of different tissues. And I can tell you from having done a lot of these experiments or putting a lot of electrodes in, every single one of these is going to be different. And you get adhesions occurring to your probes, and these are highly variable. So to have the idea that you're going to be able to extract something like a frictional coefficient based on running a cylinder in and pulling it back out is probably asking a little bit much of your system. But we wanted to try to get an idea quantitatively of the frictional forces that are acting on the probe nonetheless. So we decided to look at this area here where it's linear as we're retracting the tissue and try to basically quantify from the slope some sense of the fact that the change in the force of the distance here is the slope here, and we can actually think about this number relative to changing the probe diameter, et cetera, to get a sense of what's going on with respect to other changes in insertion. Okay, so again, we have another number we can kind of carve in our tree and say this is something useful to think about. Okay, it's probably not real important what that number is, but it's going to be important when we think about what it's relating to when we change conditions. Okay. So let's start changing some of these parameters to see what happens. So an obvious thing we've been talking about is the size is important. Okay, so logic says if we go from a pretty large probe to something somewhat smaller, that it should take less force to push in. Well, indeed, that's what we see. It takes less force. And really, kind of interestingly, we don't really see as much objection from the corpus callosum when we put it through. Okay, you don't really see a big increase in the rate of force production when you hit it. which suggests that maybe when you get down to this size range, this particular white matter tract isn't as concerned about that size probe as it was the bigger probe. So this is kind of interesting because it makes you start thinking about, well, if you're designing a probe for a particular purpose, you know, one case, a larger probe may be okay, whereas a smaller probe may be necessary in another. So it's kind of instructive to be thinking about what you see that's the same and what's different. So what we see in general is that there is a decrease in the maximum force it takes to put these probes into the full depth, which is pretty obvious. The low displacement hysteresis, so in other words, how much force you're putting in relative to what you get when you pull back out, is much larger. Okay, this is something which is kind of interesting to think about, because all of this force that you're putting into the system, I like to think of this as kind of energy that you're imparting to the system. Well, what happens when you pump energy into the brain? It's going to do something. My guess is it's usually something bad. So I would like to see this as small as possible if you're thinking about things in those terms. Okay, so seeing those differences is really important. Oops, I'm sorry. It's kind of funky. We also see that there is a change, even though you can't really see it here, in the frictional force. So there's a little bit less frictional force, which makes sense. It's a smaller probe, so there should be less compressive force acting back in the probe as you withdraw it. Okay, so that kind of follows from it, that we indeed did see it. This example isn't good for that. But we also wanted to think about tissue-specific effects. Is it going to be any different redesign a probe to go into the superficial layers of the cortex versus going to the olfactory bulb? Well, this is kind of interesting. If we look at the load displacement curves for it penetrating into the bulb, it looks kind of different. You go up, and where you see the transition, the penetration into the cortex, you see the same type of transition going into the bulb, but instead of seeing it jumping back up again, the bulb just continues on in this normal way. This really looks like what you've done is formed a really nice ring crack, which is moving very nicely, steady state. You're not increasing the force with distance. It's tearing with that same amount of force, nice and linearly, like an ideal rubber would do. Okay, so there is something fundamentally different about the structures of the cortex and the olfactory bulb that causes these changes. And again, these are fairly gross measurements, so the fine detail of it's going to be missing here. The other thing that's important is we did not see a significant change in the modulus between these tissues. But the frictional force were lower in the olfactory bulb. And exactly what explains that is not clear, unless it has something to do with some of these adhesions that we get formed when you're retracting the probes. So it may be that there's more blood loss, you know, more bleeding associated with the cortex than there is in the olfactory bulb. Exactly what the source of this is, I really have no idea. I was really interested to see what was going to happen with changes in rate. You know, this is a viscoelastic, viscoplastic material. There should be changes with rate. So we do indeed see that there are changes with rate. So these are examples of three different rates, 1 millimeter per second dropping tenfold for each of these lines. And basically see is as we decrease the rate, the amount of force it takes to insert the probe decreases. Okay, so if we go through and we look at all the values, what do we see happening? We see a significant decrease in the modulus of the material as we decrease the rate of insertion. Okay, this is what you would expect from the viscoelastic material. Okay, so this is good. The maximum force decreases. The load displacement hysteresis decreases. Now, the funny thing is, the frictional force actually goes up when we go to the slowest insertion rates. Okay, this is this whole business with adhesions. So it's suggesting that while it looks really good to put them in slowly, that it's going to be good to a point, given the same material, and at which time, if you keep going slowly, it's actually going to be worse because you're going to increase these adhesive forces, which are going to increase your lump frictional force, and it's going to continue to make problems for you. So this is important to take into consideration. Now, the Sharpen probe. Here is something that is really kind of nice. You see a very gradual increase in force as we insert it in with depth. And if we pull it back out, the unloading shape looks very similar to the same diameter flat punch. But what we see is a really nice steady increase in force. We don't have the same compression followed by penetration type of issue. And we also do not see the corpus callosum complaining about it very greatly. Okay, so you see a little bit of a bump here, but it's not real huge. So it does seem to be cutting through kind of nicely. And this, in theory, if we look again at these soft materials, should be due to the formation of what they call a mode one crack, which is basically you start cutting the tissue right off the bat, and it just opens up around your probe. So very nice gradual insertion, except for the fact that an idealized crack, type one crack, as soon as you start penetrating, you'd have constant force. This is not the case. So the tissue is pushing back in some elastic fashion that is not described by the total normal viscoelastic properties of something like rubber. So for what it's worth, it's probably due to some things like the resistance of the material, the brain from actually tearing as nicely as a uniform molecular soft material, something of this nature. Not totally clear, but this is what we find. But again, it's nice in the sense of why do we put tips on things? We know experimentally they go in better. Okay? Well, this is why. You have a nice steady increase in force, so your things tend not to bend off to the side as readily and things of this nature because they can go in with more of a gradual force building. And again, this is why you want something that is uniformly shaped. You don't want something that's kind of an odd shape because it'll cause it to push off to one side, unless that's what you're trying to achieve. All right, so we see a decrease in the maximum force of the sharpened probe. We see no change in the frictional forces during retraction. But we also want to look at what the cutting force is. So this is a way of trying to say if we're using a sharpened probe, how do we measure the forces involved with that? And basically, it comes down to, again, looking at the slopes involved with the loading slope relative to the withdrawal forces to take care of friction, et cetera, et cetera. We come up with a number, which is not terribly useful except in comparative senses, but that's how we can go about doing it. And what we found that was interesting was that there was no significant change in the cutting force. But if you go slowly, you see big transitions. So you'll see it suddenly increase and then drop again. So it makes it very difficult to really quantify at slow rates, and we basically could not do it because the error was so great, or the noise, I guess I should say, is so great. So this brings you back to the same thing, that if you go slow enough, the adhesive forces become really a confounding problem, and it keeps you from getting anywhere. The last thing that I want to talk about is there are some people that will have arguments for hours about whether you should remove the dura and pia, et cetera, before implanting your devices or not. Now, in the mouse, the dura is very thin. Most people, in just doing a basic surgery to open the skull, will remove the dura or damage it. It's not the case if you get into a rat or anything bigger. It's much thicker, and you have to surgically cut into it and retract it. It's actually difficult experimentally not to damage the dura in a mouse until you've actually done these experiments quite a bit. So we actually wanted to look at this because a lot of people would say, don't remove the dura. Shoot your electrodes pneumatically through it. Okay, and just deliver them that way because the more you open the dura, the more chance you have for infection and all sorts of other nasty things that can happen. Well, let's look at the loading slope here if we do not remove the dura. And so we see a very nice classic increase in the force and then a softening and a tearing as it goes in. And then you go very nicely back to the same trajectory as if you had removed the dura. Okay, so I think that you're probably doing quite a bit of damage when you do this. And in fact, I mean, you get a lot of bleeding if you do this, which you would normally not see if you'd already removed the dura. So you have to be doing a lot of damaging from all the dimpling of pounding the dura into the brain before it actually tears. So we made these measurements, and we didn't even quantify this force because it's highly variable. But it gives you an idea of just how much force it takes to get through the dirt if you're going to do it this way. And I guess it would be my take home that this is not necessarily what you want to do. So as I said, the real point of this was to get a ballpark number for what we wanted to do as far as the modulus of the brain so we could design an electrode. We learned other things that I think are important as far as considering what you want to do if you want to put something into the brain. We learned that points are useful. They reduce the force. And also, it's a gradual buildup of force. So mechanically, if you're trying to make a probe that's going to go into the brain, and if you want to try to soften the material you're going to put in, because we have lots of reasons now to suspect that you don't want something really rigid going into the brain, if you want to minimize the modulus of the material you stick in, you have to think about engineering the shape. So yes, we do want a point. A point's a good idea. And if you can figure out how to make the force gradual and in such a way that you can stabilize that with the shape of your probe so you have a nice kind of gradual buildup, not necessarily like this, but maybe a little wider so you, as you get closer to your thicker part of your probe, you start fanning it out more, we can now go and we can model these types of designs in order to minimize some of these effects. So we know that we want to reduce the insertion force. So again, this is part of how we design the shape and the size of the electrode. And this comes back to this idea of the more force it takes to push something in, it's naturally going to cause more damage. Okay, and it's not simply a matter of if it's big, it's going to cause displacement, so it's bad. It's also a matter of how you put it in. Can you minimize that force? Now, one thing I can't talk about is if you shoot these things in pneumatically, which is the way you put in a Utah electrode array, I don't know what the forces look like if you go to this extreme. I would really hate to try to launch this load cell at those rates. I'm not sure that we could control that properly. I know that there is somebody in California right now that's trying to do that. I don't know what kind of success they're going to have. I think you could build a sensor to do that, but they're going to try to use exactly the same probe, so we'll see what happens. I think that it's important to think about your insertion rate and the materials you're using. I think that slowing down your insertion is going to be a better idea, but you have to think about how that's going to interact with the brain. So this leads to the ideas of, can you make a really slippery probe so that you can kind of reduce these adhesive types of forces that you're going to encounter if you go slow, so that you can overcome that type of an issue. This has a backside to it, which is that if you're going to tether this to the brain, you really want to stabilize your electrode. So one of the things that people who do indwelling experiments have noticed is that once the electrodes basically become encapsulated with glia, that the recordings get better and they remain stable pretty much until they fail because they become encapsulated. So the gliosis is useful for stabilizing the implant. So it may actually be that what you really want to be looking at is how do you make the implant slippery to go in, and then think about modifying, as you were discussing, the properties of the probe once it's in there. And again, this relates back to if you want to reduce the compliance of the material, I mean, if you want to increase the compliance of the material you put into the brain, you can't make it softer than the brain to put it in. It has to be harder. But there's no reason why it can't soften once it's in the brain. So somewhat more rigid while you put it in and slippery, modifying to something that maybe astrocytes like to adhere to, but yet is compliant. So it softens a little bit, it encourages astrocytes to grow on it, and maybe the region, it's stiff enough that neurons maybe don't like it except right where your recording site is. So maybe if you have a really nice, soft recording site and a little stiffer but yet soft shaft, you have kind of a nice combination. So these are kind of the thoughts that I kind of want to leave with you as far as how you can take this type of kind of gross experiment and flip it back on itself to learn about what you might want to try to engineer as things to test out and see how well they work. So that's about all I have to say. To my knowledge, they haven't done in that detail, no. Let me take that back. So the experiments have been done, have been with large diameter punches, and they really aren't comparable. And as far as mode one, I haven't seen it. They use flat punches. Yeah. The classic mode one with a sharpened point, no. I haven't seen it, at least. So usually what you get is a centimeter or 2 centimeter diameter pressing down on the brain prior to penetration. And they don't go beyond that because they're looking at, you know, compressibility and modulus, basically. I think that there could be some possibility. Now, part of the reason we didn't push it to these extremes is that there's a fair bit of noise in these recordings. I mean, I'm showing you an example. If you go to my website, you'll see I put lots of other data on it because the journal didn't want to publish it. Okay, and I felt it was important people could actually see more curves. Okay, because there is noise and there's variability, and I think that's important. And it's going to happen that anything you design is going to have to be over-designed. You're not going to be able to go to the absolute minimum because it'll fail most of the time because you're going to have little changes that are going to make it not work. Yeah, so you can't push the limits on this. You're going to have to stay back somewhat. But what would be really nice is to combine this type of study with imaging where you can actually look at the stresses involved in the tissue and actually see what's happening while you're building up these forces. I think that'll provide some insight. If you have nice plastic parts, you could do that just fine. And I don't have access to that equipment. I could make the probes. Well, let's talk about it because, yes, I think one of the things we were doing with this, as I mentioned, we were talking about polymer-based probes. So I do have experience now in making really nice, tiny polymer bits, if you will, electrodes as well. So, you know, that is all very doable. And these can be done in systems that can change their properties with time, et cetera. So, and they're very biocompatible. So this is not, you know, totally science fiction. It's very doable. So, if you do these things nicely, you actually don't see much dimpling. Okay, so if you keep the surface of the brain moist, you don't get a huge compression sort of thing. It is a more gradual thing, and then it really, you know, it isn't as steep a transition as you might think. Okay, so with the olfactory bulb recordings, you saw it a little bit more. The cortex seems to release a little more gradually, so there's kind of a shoulder as you go into the second phase. It's not a real steep transition, so it's kind of tearing before it propagates. And again, it doesn't propagate properly. It should be nice and flat. You know, the force-distance relationship should be flat, and it doesn't do that. So it's kind of tearing poorly, if you will.
Gently,
yes. I mean, it's separating. And again, if you go slower, you don't get these steep transitions. It's even more gradual. And I don't suggest that you want to be putting really flat objects in. I think that you really do want to have, you know, something to help spread the tissue. But yet we do have a series of very useful electrodes out there that are flat-bottomed. OK? Okay, so some of the silicon electrodes that have multiple side recording sites, that's exactly what they are. They're about 40 microns by 100 microns in diameter at their bases. You know, the rectangles that get shoved in. So you're going to have really kind of an ugly mess going down at the bottom of those. The first part I missed. I'm suggesting what for that purpose? I'm suggesting that you need to open the dura, yes. Oh, I don't care about the top of the cortex. Sorry, no. There's nothing perfect. The bottom line is most people are interested in what's happening deeper in. And this is kind of the neurosurgeon's perspective of we have to do something. And so it's a matter of balance. I think that you're probably going to do better in the long term working with the brain if you can get better access to it without causing a huge amount of damage just getting there. So a good controlled opening of the dura is going to be a good step in that direction. And neurosurgeons do this all the time. They incise the dura, they pull it back, and away they go. Now, in mice, you might argue it's so thin, why would you have to do it? Well, that shows you why you would have to do it even in a mouse.
Where the puncture that you showed with the dura on the shard tip?
So the shard tip, it usually doesn't penetrate that far before it tears. It'll tear more rapidly. But again, that depends on just, you know, if your goal is to make a softer probe, which is what we were thinking about, having the dura intact is going to put a huge burden on that probe to begin with, because we're still going to have a larger force to overcome. It doesn't just cut through. It is steeper.
Except if you refollow your idea of, like, the probe is, like, so sharp that it starts stiff, and in the end, it's soft.
But now we're going to have to do this within, you know, a couple seconds or even less. Okay, what I'm thinking about is you do your insertion, and over the course of the next day, you modify the properties of the surface of the probe or the entire probe over the course of a week or a month. Because you're talking about changing probably bonding within the material, or that you're going to have bulk etching of the material, degradation of the material. So these are slower processes. They can be more rapid, but then you get into really having to fine-tune your surgery.